You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Hello, my listeners. Just a quick preface before this episode about the audio quality happening in this recording you're about to hear. I apologize. Something went wrong in the either my computer or the mix board, and I think it ended up recording not the way I wanted it to. So it sounds a little different. It just sounds like Rob and I in a room. So please bear with, as I feel like it was a fun discussion and I wanted y'all to hear it, but I just wanted to let you know ahead of time that the audio is a little lower quality than I normally strive for with the show. Anyway, I hope you dig this episode nonetheless. Thanks.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Just the Discs. My name's Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have a good friend returning to the show after a long hiatus, which is my fault, and I apologize, sir.
I did retire briefly there.
Oh, you did retire? Okay.
Yes, so right. We're both at fault.
Okay, well, this is my friend Rob Galuzzo is joining me again. Thank you, Rob, for coming back.
Of course, man, of course. So we'd done a couple of Just the Discs episodes where we talked about a collection. But really, the episode that blew me away was the Teen Wolf one.
Because that was
awesome. Of course, it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and so when you asked me to talk about it, I was more than happy to. And then we did it, and just the job that you did editing in interviews and trailer clips and music and everything was so spectacular. And when I complimented you on it, you were like, well, we can do one for 3 o'clock high. And I was like, well, I am in. So it's taken a while. This disc has obviously been out through Shout Select for several months now.
Yes.
But it is available, and it's one of our personal favorites, and that's what this episode is about. We're going to dive into 3 o'clock high from 1987.
I guess I should have known from the beginning it was going to be one of those days.
His name is
Jerry Mitchell.
Hi, Jerry.
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 Hi, I'm Jerry Mitchell. I'm with the school paper.
He just met the new kid in school.
The guy's the closest thing to Charlie Manson ever seen at Weaver.
Now,
we're gonna have a fight today after school.
He's got 6 hours to get out of it.
It's been quite a morning, Jerry.
You can say that again.
He'll try running.
I wouldn't leave school without a good reason.
He'll try bribery.
If I can get that money, do you think you'd do it for me?
Ravel will never bother you again, guaranteed.
He'll try robbery.
I hear you're giving Jerry Mitchell a hard time.
Till finally,
the fight is on. You and me in the parking lot, 3 o'clock.
Jerry's got a lot on his mind.
10 seconds.
But he's not thinking about math or English.
5 seconds.
Because at 3 o'clock, he's going to make history.
There isn't going to be any fight today!
Absolutely, yeah. This is, I don't know about you, but this for me is like Teen Wolf in a lot of ways in terms of like just an all-time favorite for years and years, and one that I feel like I've had to turn more people onto than Teen Wolf, because Teen Wolf, yeah, just people seem to know that movie a little bit more. But I have a similar love and passion for it.
Yeah. No, I'm surprised. The way I discovered this, because it came out in 87. I was too young to see it in theaters. It was a cable stable. It was on HBO nonstop. So much so that, in fact, when I think I first got the VHS for it, I had never seen the first 5-10 minutes. Like, I'd always caught it. I always caught it from the bathroom scene, which is about 15 minutes in, where Jerry Mitchell, our protagonist and hero, who's kind of the nerdy guy that works for the school newspaper, it wants to do a piece on Buddy Ravel, who is the new kid in the school, and who is a giant. He's just this giant, towering, scary, scary young man who's got this rumor, you know, it's rumored that he's killed people and, you know, that he keeps getting bounced.
Knife to coach or something.
Yeah, knife to coach, all that kind of stuff, the fun stuff that you get in high school. And I'd always come into the point where he accidentally touches him.
What I'm trying to find out is, you are Buddy Ravel, right?
a narc?
No, I'm with the school paper.
What do you want, man? I just got to this school.
I don't want anything. That is all. All I want to do is talk to you, see? See, they told me to write this stupid little piece about you because you're the new kid on campus.
You're going to do a stupid little piece on me? Why would I want to look stupid?
No. You're not going to look stupid. Not at all. And incidentally, just so you know, I don't care if you do all kinds of dope and shit. I'm not anybody's narc, you know? Oh, not that I think that you do dope or anything like that. I mean, listen, why don't we forget this whole thing and pretend this never happened, okay?
You're never gonna forget this happened.
And that causes him to challenge him to a fight at 3 o'clock after school. And I don't know what it is about the movie. I think it's just, and this is part of, we'll get into it, but this is part of Spielberg's problem with the movie and why he took his name off it, is that it's so different from the John Hughes era of stuff. But to me, it's more real. Like, I related more to this movie than the John Hughes movies. The John Hughes movies I loved, but those were the kids I wish I knew and was friends with, because he even made the nerds seem cool in his movies, when in real life that was not the case at all. In real life, I was very much more Jerry Mitchell.
Same here.
And so I think I related to that, the fact that this was a real challenge, and also, like, just on a, before I had a grasp on filmmaking technique, I could sense that there was something special about this movie, the way it was all put together. And I'd always said, you know, obviously this is all leading up to 3 o'clock when he's going to fight, you know, David and Goliath. It's the you know, the small guy fighting the giant bully. And the way that that scene happens, like the whole school is there, it's shot like the freaking end of Rocky. It's like so epic, this
that
fight
or,
sequence.
Or like a gladiator fucking arena.
It is so good. It's so good. And then it turns out, who's the DP on this?
Well, I mean, Sonnenfeld is credited as a lighting consultant. In the commentary, he says, I think he shot it, but yeah. They had to have a standby DP because he wasn't in the union or something.
Right.
It was a union show. So Sonnenfeld, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, he went on to be a great director in his own right. So the fact that you have somebody like that as the DP, it's just, this movie is much, much more polished and well orchestrated than a lot of the teen comedies of that time period. And I mean, look, I love them all. You love them all. Mm-hmm. But that there was something just a little extra special about this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that stylization that director Phil Juanu does so well from the get-go, I mean, from the opening shot of, you know, it's an overhead shot of Jerry and it comes down to the side of him and he, you know, and there's just every bit of the opening scene is stylized. His sister's throwing him the car keys, you know, there's just quick cuts everywhere. And then he's got that amazing, like, Orson Welles shot of, like, the kids walking into the school. And he's following one group after another, talking about Buddy Revell.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, this new guy is supposed to be a total psycho. I heard he broke another kid's neck at his last school.
Then he got kicked off the football team for throwing a knife on a coach.
And all the coach did was grab him, and the guy goes nuts.
And this guy's supposed to be coming to our school
today.
After he broke that kid's neck, they tried to throw him in jail. The judge let him off.
This guy ought to be locked up. Did you hear what he did at Lincoln? They were supposed to be dissecting these pregnant sand sharks, but he refused to do it. He said sharks were his favorite animal.
Create a psychotic shark lover.
So the teacher grabs him by the arm and tries to take him down to the office. Thing is, the teacher didn't know the guy was a touch freak.
Touch freak?
Yeah. He doesn't like to be touched by anybody. He put the teacher in the hospital for 3 days.
Just because he touched him? This guy is definitely on pill.
That's not even the whole story. After he duped the science teacher, they send the dude into continuation. And on the first day there, he got into a fight with the three baddest dudes. Seriously totaled their asses at the same time.
Have you heard about his brass knuckles?
The dude has brass knuckles? Yeah, always carries them with him. He uses them on special occasions.
He hit that continuation so hard his nose flew off his face.
Serious?
Totally serious. He's also got this thing about being touched.
I heard he one time broke a guy's neck just because he touched him.
Just because he touched him?
He just decided he didn't like to be touched.
That's completely weird.
Does this guy play football?
No.
Good.
Used to, though.
Remember the story about the guy who pulled a knife on his coach?
Yeah.
That's him.
Jesus.
He was a continuation. He even took a swing at one of his teachers. And these guys aren't your average history types. They're like ex-cops or something. In fact, I heard they carry guns.
He came here from continuation?
Uh-huh. That's why they call it continuation, so you can continue murdering people and still graduate.
It's a really great expository scene.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favorites. And then the great shot of Buddy's foot, like, coming out of the car, which is the shot I think I was going to tell you I think they stole for Stranger Things season 2. I swear there's a shot.
I don't doubt it at all.
You know,
I'm sure it's a homage to
If you watch the beginning of 3 O'Clock High and go watch Stranger Things season 2, there's a shot where one of the kids drops a boot out of a car and it looks, to me, just like the shot. Like,
yeah.
There's a movement to the left of the back of the car, and I swear it's all there, but maybe I'm hallucinating.
I know, I think so. I think those guys are referencing this for sure.
Yeah, but there was something about that, and like you're saying, like, it does feel more real in the way that all that stylization makes everything feel so heightened, and everything in high school is already heightened, but it kind of really puts a finer point on it by making everything just feel like the end of the fucking world. And, you know, I mean, the John Hughes movies did that to a degree, but not in the sense of, like, putting you in it psychologically,
yeah,
like this does. So I think that's a thing, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just so funny, man. So
yeah.
Funny.
I think I had actually, what happened was a year or two ago, last summer, my buddy Scott Reynolds, he's got a giant projection and screen in his backyard, and so he hosts backyard screenings. And so he always has different themes every summer, and I think his theme last year was like high school comedies.
That's so cool.
And so he'd alternate. So of course The Breakfast Club was in there, and, you know, some different things. And he'd asked me to pick a movie. He's like, "Oh, pick one from that era." And I said 3 O'Clock High, and he'd never seen it, never heard of it.
Oh, wow.
The same with his family and the friends that usually come to these things. And it was probably the least attended of his backyard screenings, unfortunately. Actually, that's how Elric saw it for the first time.
I was there.
As I told him,
oh,
I was like, "Dude, you have to come and see it. We're going to show it in Scott's backyard today."
Fantastic.
And I think they were all kind of blown away. They were blown away by the movie. And so seeing it that way with a bunch of people for the first time projected after having seen it on cable forever. And I think I just also rewatched Just One of the Guys, which if they ever do a Blu-ray, there will be an episode of that as well.
Absolutely.
I think those two films have, and Teen Wolf, have perfect scripts. I mean, the way that the three acts are structured, you get where everyone's coming from, and then even just the jokes, the timing of it all. I mean, of course, the direction has a lot to do with it, but just on a screenwriting level, when you see, like, just you get it. Like, Jerry gets challenged to do this thing, he's going to fight the bully at 3 o'clock, and then basically the movie is in real time where there's like all these shots of the clock, which even if you weren't going to fight a bully, you just couldn't wait for school to end anyway. So like we all relate to just staring at that damn clock and
yeah,
how slow it just clicks from one thing to the next. But for him, it's signaling and counting down to his inevitable destruction. And I mean, again, it's like as soon as he gets challenged, he goes into class and there's like a film about like the bugs. Like their whole like the predators versus the,
oh,
you know,
oh god, so good.
Yeah, like it just immediately hammers home, which, you know, they do the exact same thing in Teen Wolf where as soon as he realizes he's a wolf, now all of a sudden there's all these, the entire day is all about wolves. You know, a book by Thomas Wolfe, or, you know, it's hammering home that point, and they do the same thing in this movie.
Yeah,
where as soon as he's, you know, challenged to fight, it's like he's seeing this bug. Actually, another thing. Sorry to go on so many tangents.
No,
here.
I like tangents.
A while back, a good friend of mine named Paul Sollett, who's a really
director,
incredibly talented writer and director, and he had, you know, he has since done Bullethead is his newest movie. His first movie was called Grace, and way before Grace, even before he had the short film version of it, his first notable short film was called Means to an End. It's on the Fangoria Blood Drive disc, and possibly volume 2. And it's him and his co-writer at the time, Jake Hamilton. They are aspiring effects artists that want to break into the business, and they can't get a break at all. Nobody wants to read their stupid scripts. And basically they're like, "Man, you know, what happened to the good old days of effects and this and that? What do we got to do to get people to notice us? Like, kill each other?" And they're like, "Wait a minute."
Oh, that's
and
cool.
So their effects are real. It's basically them torturing each other on film to wow people. But the line, the tagline of it is, "Pain is temporary, film is forever." And I remember going to Paul, and I don't know, maybe it was a subconscious thing, but I said to him, I was like, that's totally from 3 O'Clock High, right? And he's like, no, I just, it came out of the idea of effects guys torturing each other on film just to become notorious. And I'm like, well, it is a line in 3 O'Clock High. And the way it plays into 3 O'Clock High is one of the many things that happens to Jerry is he thinks Buddy is coming after him in the bathroom, and instead the door slams open and sees two film students.
Jerry, how do you feel about your chance in the fight this afternoon?
Have you ever been seriously threatened
Jerry,
before,
Jerry? Jerry, have any insurance?
I didn't
Jerry,
have any insurance.
Jerry,
you've
been shit. Do you have any insurance whatsoever?
Damn it, you guys, this is not a movie. This is my life we're talking about here.
Oh, come on, man. Pain is temporary. Film is forever.
So that becomes like a plot point in the background. I mean, there's so many little
things
like
that. That's so funny
that
he hadn't seen it and he just came up with
it. Hadn't seen it, and it was the same tagline, which I still think is brilliant, and I say to this day.
Yeah, it's wonderful. There's so many things that I love about it, but the general cohesiveness of the stylization, the portrayals of Jerry Mitchell by Casey Shimasko and Buddy Revelle by Richard Tyson are just for the books. Like, some of the greatest... I mean, you know, people get rewarded for acting all the time, Academy Awards, whatever, and a movie like this is completely passed over when you have two actors that absolutely nail these characters and make the movie completely unforgettable. One of the things Phil Juanu comes back to a few times in the special features is that people remember these characters' names.
Yeah.
And it's because of these actors. It's because of the way that they portray them.
You can have the exact same script and cast it one way and it just won't work. You cast it another way, and it elevates it to a whole nother level. We did an open casting call, literally open. Like, we're advertised, and unknowns could come in. We did it in L.A., we did it in Chicago, and we did it in New York. Well, thousands of people came through, and hundreds auditioned for me. It was a long process, because really, everyone in the movie was an unknown at the time. It was long, drawn out. We had a bunch of different choices, and then Steven wanted to do screen tests for everybody. So we went on a stage, and the top kind of 3-4 choices for Jerry and Buddy came in. And at the end of the day, it was Casey and Richard. And Casey, he's just funny as hell. I mean, he was just funny, and he would go for it, and he was manic. And to me, he felt like an everyman. Not Casey as an actor, but the character kind of generic. It you know, kind of like just the guy. He's just the guy. He's just a straight ahead guy. Hey, what happened? What? Oh crap! And Casey could play that. He could just play this, like his little haircut. You know, he was just so the kind of average kid. Richard was much more method and Buddy, and you know, I'm Buddy Revelle, and he was really living it and eating it up and being it. To me, they're the reason why the movie continues to resonate at all with people.
They are these guys. For a lot of people, they don't know these actors outside of this movie.
I've always, Richard Tyson, I only recently knew his name. I always call him Buddy Revelle. You know, it's like, that's Buddy Revelle, man. Holy smokes.
Yeah, I mean, he's been in some Farrelly Brothers movies and other stuff, but I mean, I hate to have an actor not have a career outside of a single movie, but in some ways, there is something to be said for an actor being in too many movies, because I can only emotionally connect and remember them forever as a character if they're in a handful of movies.
Both have two, though. Yeah. Richard Tyson has got this in Kindergarten Cop.
Oh, that's right.
You never forget that he's the villain of that.
Yes.
I'm a police officer. Crisp, you're under arrest. Put your hands on your head, slowly. And get up.
Kimball, not again.
Your hands.
They're up. When are you going to leave me alone?
Drop the gun! Yeah, that's right. Drop the gun!
Hey, I'm a police officer. This is an arrest.
This man is crazy. Look at him. He wants to kill me. You're just going to stand there?
Freeze!
Oh, jeez.
I'm a cop, you idiot. I'm Detective John Kimball. This man is under arrest.
Yeah, we'll see about that. I'm checking it out.
You can't just walk in here and put a gun in my face. I'm trying to get a manicure. I have witnesses.
I have a witness, too. It's murder one this time. Now you're mine.
And Casey has this in Young Guns.
Yes.
So they have gotten out of the one and done. But most people know them as these two characters.
Yeah, but they just nailed it. And so I think that's a big part of it, too. But I was so excited when this Blu-ray got announced, man. It was one of those that I was just kind of waiting and waiting and waiting and hoping it would happen. And
yeah.
Now we have it in our hands. and Shout Factory Select. I mean, thankfully, Phil Juanu is really one of those guys who's pretty widely available. Like, I've heard him on the How's This Movie podcast. Dana Buckler's really good friends with him, so he's been on that show, like, countless times, a bunch. So he's very available. And so they were able to get him to do a commentary.
Yeah.
And there's an interview with him, and...
Yeah, we should give a little context to who he is, especially now in the business. So 3 o'clock High was one of his first feature. He was kind of this film student, like wunderkind, that got discovered by Spielberg. And so he made this movie, which did not do well. And, you know, we'll get into that when we talk about the features and how it evolved and changed. But he had already booked U2's Rat on Hum, which was their live movie sort of documentary thing. And so, in fact, I believe... And they showed 3 o'clock High and Rattle and Hum at the New Bev as a double bill.
Oh,
and he was
cool.
There in between the movies.
That's cool.
So he had gone on to do that. And so he kind of was in that world where he was doing U2 music videos for a while. And in terms of features, there's not a lot, but he had done micro-budget Blumhouse movie not too long ago. And then most recently, the thing that really caused a lot of noise was he had done a short film called Dirty Laundry with Thomas Jane. And what it was, you know, Thomas Jane, great. I love Thomas Jane. He's a great actor. He was at one point the Punisher in one of those, one of the many attempts to do the Punisher. And I actually think he's a great Frank Castle. I just think he's in the worst scripted of all the movies. Like, unfortunately, it's like it's not the right mix of what Frank Castle and the Punisher needs to be. But he took a lot of ownership over that character. And so a couple years ago for Comic-Con, they surprised everybody and made a new Punisher short film with Thomas Jane as... I mean, they never say that he's the Punisher or say that he's Frank Castle, but you know that's what it is. And Phil Juneau was the one that directed that.
Oh, nice.
And so it debuted at Comic-Con. It's on YouTube. It's really great. It's super hyper-violent. And basically, Thomas Jane is doing his laundry and he goes into a liquor store and there's a bunch of punks out there that start harassing people, and he's like, do I get involved? All right, I get involved. And he just basically, like, very violently takes these guys down, and at the they start shooting at him. And so at the end, like, you know, part of his laundry gets a bullet hole in it, and the kid is like, hey man, you forgot your laundry. He's like, oh, you keep it. And the kid pulls the shirt out. It's the Punisher logo.
Nice.
And so it's like saying it's the Punisher. But
that's so cool. Oh man.
Phil had done that. And so and when I looked at it, I was like, oh my God, that's the guy that directed 3 o'clock High. That's great that he's, you know, still around. And I interviewed him for his Blumhouse movie, which I'm going to look up because the name escapes me. It ended up debuting on I think it was a Netflix. Like, there was a period where they had Blumhouse had 3 micro budget movies. His was called The Veil.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah. And it debuted on Netflix. And I talked to him for The Veil when we were doing the Blumhouse website. And the first thing I said is like, dude, 3 o'clock High is one of my favorite movies of all time. And he to this day is still shocked that so many people say that to him. And he's like, man, that's the movie that just keeps coming back.
Yeah, man. You know? No, I mean, it's something else. It really came out at the right time. And it wasn't why. I think it was because of that cable thing and because people didn't all see it.
Yeah.
Like, they all saw the John Hughes stuff, that I think it was one of those movies that's just been passed around and passed around for years. He also did a great movie called State of Grace.
Oh, yeah. That one I haven't seen.
Oh, you'd like that. It's really great. I think it's Irish mobsters with Sean Penn. Like...
A friendship stained by blood.
Jimmy Cavallo keeps getting up in the morning till I say different. You got that?
A love shattered by violence.
But I should have told him what you were.
A man caught up by fear.
It's 15,000. The minute he takes his last breath, you bring me his rat head, it's 30,000.
And torn apart by betrayal.
Well, who did you say?
I don't want to do this anymore!
Let's go!
State of Grace.
Starts Friday, September 14th. Special limited engagement at the Highland, Fairview, and Sherwood.
It's really solid. Really great. I mean, stylized in a different way just shows, like, how sharp he is as a director. I mean, he's really a talented guy. Like, in, like, I'm sure these shorts show.
They're great. And so here's the irony about this movie. So he was hired by Spielberg on the basis of his short films to do it. This is all talked about on the commentary and the special features. And it was originally a script called, I think it was called After School.
Yeah.
And it was a lot more goofy, comedic. It was basically a Hughes knockoff. But it already had the green light. It was going to get made no matter what. And so he came on board and was like, I like this, but I want to rewrite it make it a little bit more my style. And so he did, and his biggest influence was Scorsese's After Hours.
Which totally makes sense when you watch it.
Yeah. And so that was his version of this story. And part of it was, I don't want to make a John Hughes movie. Like, those already exist. There's so many ripoff movies to that. I want something that stands out and is a little bit different. However, when Spielberg saw the final version of the movie, he hated it so much, he took his name off of it. So his name is nowhere on 3 O'Clock High.
It's so sad to me. I just can't believe that.
That proves to me that Steven Spielberg is not always right. Definitely not. I think he is so wrong.
Yeah. I would love to think that if you talk to him now, he's like, oh, no. You know, like, I just can't believe that he couldn't have... Anyway, whatever.
You mean the director of BFG is going to admit he's wrong?
Maybe not.
Hey, but I loved Ready Player One, so...
Yeah, me too.
But I just was so shocked to hear that. Yeah. And, you know, it puts a damper... If your first movie was championed by Steven Spielberg and then he takes his name off of it right before it comes out...
That's rough.
Who knows what that does to your career? But I think the reason this movie has sustained and become a cult classic is because it's not a John Hughes ripoff. And it's its own thing. And that's what you and I have gravitated towards. It's like, wait, this is totally a different vibe.
Yeah.
And this feels like the most adult teen movie I've ever seen. Or at least putting you in that perspective of what it felt like to be a teen with adult problems.
Yeah.
And where nobody listens to you. This guy wants to beat the shit out of you. The girl you like doesn't know you exist. But then even that brings the funny thing. I don't know if it's the moral of the movie, but basically this challenge, this thing that he has to figure out how to overcome is kind of what makes him an attractive man. You know, like, one of the many things he does is to get kicked out of school is he hits on the teacher with this book report, which kind of backfires on him in the most amazing way.
Yeah, that's one for the ages, that whole bit, that scene and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, now we're going to try and get through as many book reports as we can today. Are there any volunteers?
Yo.
Jerry. All right. Go ahead.
Let me ask you a question. Why am I standing here? I mean, the whole point of books is that you read them. Many start telling people about them, that means that they didn't read them, which means that book reports contribute to illiteracy, which is part of a real big social problem in America.
Jerry, did you actually read a book?
Did you give me a break?
Well, could we...
I'm trying to make a point here.
Jerry.
You don't think that I could stand here and tell you about a book I read? Is that what you think? Ha!
Jerry. The book.
Fine, book.
Honey Goes to Hollywood.
So I think that's all the things that make it as great as it is. And if you want to talk features, I think I learned a lot about the things we're talking about in terms of people's reactions to the movie and how it did through Phil Juneau's commentary with Michael Felcher. And there's an interview segment with him, too, where he's very candid about it. And candid and humble about all this stuff.
Absolutely. That's the other thing I really like. As talented as he obviously is, he is in no way sort of bragging about anything. Like, he's just very like, yeah, I did this thing, and I'm so glad people still appreciate it. You know, I love that. But, yeah, I love the whole After Hours thing as being an influence, and it totally makes sense because I love After Hours, too, and it's like Griffin Dunn is trapped in Soho, Jerry Mitchell is trapped in the high school.
Yeah.
It's very much that sort of thing. But he said it's also inspired by The Road Warrior, which I think is really interesting, and you can kind of see that as well on some level in terms of like the epic stylization and the violence in the movie, you know, that's just kind of way over the top, you know, like everything.
Everybody in this movie, no matter how small their role, is a character that you immediately... I think that's the brilliance in casting sometimes. This is one of the best examples of where casting is so spot on from top to bottom. So you have people like Jeffrey Tambor as the guy that runs the school store, and he's so intense.
So good.
What has happened here is so heinous, I almost can't bear to show it to you.
I can take it.
God. It isn't just vandalism, Jerry. We're talking about grand theft. Look at this. weekly earnings are gone.
But I thought grand theft was if you stole $500 or more.
This is so stupid. Why would anybody do something like this? God damn it!
Maybe it was some sort of freak accident.
Accident? You gotta be kidding me. Look at the place. Look at it! It's no accident. As far as I am concerned, whoever did this is a criminal. Whoever did this should be plucked out of our school like a burgeoning cancerous growth deep inside the colon.
I couldn't agree with you more, sir.
Philip Baker Hall, who plays he's the detective once this whole, basically, at one point Jerry tries to hire somebody to fight Buddy for him, and so he kind of steals money from the school store, and that becomes a whole side plot, and that backfires. Mitch Pelligi, I mean,
oh gosh,
you know, Horace Pinker from Shocker and from X-Files, and here he is as like the security guy. He's only got like two or three scenes in the movie, and he steals the shit. I mean, the second you see him, you know that guy.
You tell all your little friends there's no escape from the Duker. You got that?
Yeah, yes.
Good.
That was the guy that was security at high school. You're like, or just the security guy that anytime you go into any place, you're like, oh, he's that guy. You know, the same thing with the principal. It's like the second you see them, you know who they are.
Yeah.
And I think that's the brilliance of the casting in this thing.
Yeah, there's tons of other faces you'll recognize, too. The woman who's one of the stars of The Honeymoon Killers, I can't think of the actress's name right now. She's the principal's assistant. Even she's got, like, her own thing, you know, like, Jerry Mitchell's file, Mr. D. Just the way that she's, you know, just, she's so perfect. But yeah, it's incredible how spot on the casting is in this movie. And a very young Paul Feig even shows up for a second.
I didn't know that until the commentary.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. He's got one line.
I'm just going to talk to Buddy Revell and tell him that there's no reason for us to fight, and that's all there is to it. I mean, nobody has to know.
Jerry Mitchell?
Yeah?
I heard you're going to fight Buddy Revell after school today.
No, there's not going to be
any. You a black belt or something? You look kind of small. Well, good luck.
Well, wait. Man, who travels fast?
That's amazing.
Giannu jokingly says that he launched his career.
Yeah, well, he did.
In a way, because he's saying, now I didn't know this was the case, but he's like, he lived out there and he moved to LA after this movie, is what he said. So
he is responsible for
that. That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. You know, there's something he said.
And then Yearly Smith, who's the voice of Lisa Simpson. Mm-hmm. And you'd know her right away. Herman's Head, which I'm sure you grew up on too.
I loved Herman's Head.
Loved Herman's Head.
But yeah, she opens and closes the movie, basically, because she's one of the first people. This guy's a total psycho.
Well, and which is funny, because it's this great bookend where in the opening they're talking about Buddy Revell, and in the closing moments they're talking about Jerry Mitchell. And what's funny, at least for me on repeat viewings, is the way that the Jerry Mitchell mythos and legend gets exaggerated in the closing credits makes me think, maybe Buddy Revell wasn't all that bad a guy.
Yeah.
Maybe that's all talk at the beginning. And who knows? Maybe he just has a thing about, you know what I want right now? I want a Cobra Kai style sequel to 3 o'clock High from Buddy Revell's point of view.
Dude.
About how he never recovered from that little kid that picked on him and beat him up. I just think the world is ready for that now.
Oh, boy. YouTube Red, get on that shit,
right?
Man.
Let's do that.
I'm in. I am so in.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's no, there's something to that. There definitely is something to that. I mean, Buddy definitely does show that he has an ability as a fighter at one point in really beating the shit out of somebody. So there is something to him hurting people, but you don't think maybe all of that is.
But he's a smart guy.
Yeah.
Because there's that moment where Jerry lets him cheat off him, assuming like, oh, maybe he'll leave me alone about this. And basically in front of the principal shows that he didn't need his help.
Yeah.
He was just doing it to fuck with him.
Yeah.
And to me, like, that says a lot about his character.
Absolutely.
He's smarter and better, or he thinks he's smarter and better than everybody else.
Yeah.
So
now there's a lot to the Buddy character that we don't know. And one of my favorite moments with him is that smile at the end.
Yeah.
It's like I always almost pause it because it's just a slight turn of, it's like his eyes and just the edge of his mouth.
Yeah.
And it's not anything, like, I don't know how many takes they have, but God, Richard Tyson just nails it. It's like the perfect, like, respect, kind of.
Even that shot with the fist coming in a frame. Yes, and yes. You're like, is he going to punch him? It's like, dude, nope, the cash comes out. Yeah, and you're like, oh, man. My God. You'll understand if you see the movie. Actually, yeah. You should probably watch the movie definitely before you listen to this.
Hopefully you've seen the movie. If you haven't seen the movie, I don't think this is really spoiling, because I feel like once you see it, the way that it's stylized, it's almost like you can't spoil it in an audio way. It's hard to explain, but anyway, what are some of the other stuff that you dug from the features that you learned? Anything that stands out?
Mostly it's the history of the movie through the, it's an interview with Phil Janelle called Head of the Class. And that's kind of, almost all the information I've been relaying has come from that. Actually, I didn't get a chance to watch the interview with the screenwriters, one of which is Richard Christian.
It just dropped into my head. I thought, I had been like every guy I know. At one point when I was a kid, somebody wanted to beat me up after school. And it was a horrible, horrible trauma. And, you know, you never really forget it. And the things that happen later in your life as an adult become like metaphoric versions of weird way. But it just came to me, and I thought, a kid's going to, you know, a terrible kid, really mean kid, is transferring into a high school. A decent kid pisses him off inadvertently.
What he didn't realize is that some of the giants of show business had the same exact experience
including one particular giant, Steven Spielberg, who in fact ended up casting the bully that picked on him in one of his little movies that he made, which is how he got around getting beat up
when he was a kid.
But what was so cool about it was, you know, in a storytelling structure, you're always looking for the steps, and it was six periods, and so each period was, how do I get out of the fight? How do I bribe somebody to do it for me? Do I bribe the bully? Do I act like I'm, you know, having a heart attack so they'll send me home? I mean, it was just so perfectly structural in terms of those periods. Right. And so I just thought, well, this is really cool. And so I told Tom. Tom, you know, we were totally excited about it, and so we just plunged in.
And ironically, in some ways, the character who is the most memorable is Buddy Revell. Because he represents that which has frightened everyone at one point or another in their lives. Well, there was a guy in my high school named Barry Revell, who is sadly no longer with us. But he was absolutely intimidating, to me anyway, when I was in high school.
We were meeting the heads of studios, like at Warner, and they would all tell us the same story, that they had been Jerry Mitchell, and that they, you know, it really resonated for them in a real way.
Really.
Yeah, what are my notes from that? Just that they mentioned that Spielberg didn't love it. He took his name off it because of how it was shot, and that...
You were wrong, Spielberg.
Yes.
Sorry, you were wrong.
And that they said that Spielberg once said he had visited the set and told Phil to just set the camera still and let people talk, and Phil didn't do that. So that's probably part of the reason, too, that Spielberg may have at some point been said, no, do it like this, and then Phil didn't do it like that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that was a, you know, point of contention.
But that's why the movie works.
Absolutely.
It's because of those crane shots and, like, all that kind of stuff they do.
No, it's not the movie that we love if it's not that way.
There's also an interview with Jane Rum, who, she pops up quite a bit in these. She's a costume designer, and I had actually interviewed her a few times for the Corman releases, because she got her start with Roger Corman.
Nice.
And she, you know, I don't want to spoil, but she tells an incredible story about David Carradine on, I think it's the Death Race disc.
Oh, nice.
I interviewed her for that, and she told a story about how he kind of offended her almost right away, and she, like, wanted to quit the job. Like, she basically quit. And it's one of the things about, I'll do the brief version, but basically how much Carradine respected Roger. Because Roger got wind of it and basically said to Carradine, if you don't go and apologize to that girl, you're off this film.
Wow.
And so she was telling a story that she's at her apartment, got a knock on the door, she opens it, and there's Carradine with his acoustic guitar, and asking if he'd come in for a few minutes, and he came in and sang songs for her and stuff.
Holy
and
shit.
That was his way of apologizing for being a little too rude.
Wow.
Because his outfit was a little uncomfortable in that movie, so he maybe took it out on her.
Oh my God.
But that was the beginning of her career, and she has since gone on to be quite a well-known costume designer.
She tells a really good story about how Richard Tyson showed up late to his first fitting and he was bleeding because apparently he'd gotten in a fight on the way to the fitting.
He is Buddy Revell.
It's so funny. But I loved the Head of the Class interview. He's talking about his fandom for Jaws and that made him want to be a director. I think he even uses music from Jaws during that bug film that you talked about, which apparently shot himself. It's like a scorpion spider or scorpion like eating a cricket. And Phil was really apologetic that he actually killed a cricket for the movie.
Right.
Because he shot that. But he's like, it is what they eat. So that's really cool.
And that's why the movie didn't do well. People found out about the cricket death.
He talks about Last Chance Dance, which is a student film that Spielberg saw and called him up and basically it impressed him so much. You can go to Phil's website. I think it's Phil Juanu, director, and you can watch Last Chance Dance, and I do recommend it. It's a fun little short for sure. And Boof is in Last Chance Dance. Boof from Teen Wolf. So Rob, you got to see it.
Go on as soon as we finish this.
Yes, absolutely. So a little connector between 3 o'clock Eye and Teen Wolf.
Yeah. Well, I have two more bits to add to this conversation. Number one, here's a cameo that I don't think is referenced at all. I don't even know if it's a cameo or just a coincidence, but it's one of the first obscure character faces and names that I've ever picked up in a movie before, which is, I'd seen this a million times, and when I was watching on cable, there's the scene in the end where all the kids, basically, Jerry won the fight. He needs to raise the money that he initially stole, and so the entire school rallies to the school store and offers to buy one sheet of paper for $1, and that's how it goes. But one of the first people that comes up and says, oh, how much is it? $1 sheet? Great. I'll take whatever, $5. Is actually Brian Andrews, the little kid that played Tommy Doyle in Halloween.
No way. The original Halloween.
And it's because he still looks like Tommy Doyle. He looks totally different now. But he's a teenager, and I don't know why. It's just the way his voice is and the way he looks. When that happened, I was like, that's the little kid from Halloween. And I go on IMDb and look it up. I'm like, yep, sure enough.
That's
and
awesome.
I'm curious because they reference Paul Feig on the commentary and stuff, but they never referenced that. Paul had said that they actually cast a lot of local actors in Utah.
Yes.
They shot this in Utah. So a lot of the people at the school are actual local kids. So I wonder if after Halloween, you know,
Tommy moved to
Utah, and that's how he ended up in this movie again. But it's literally like the only other credit I could find on him.
Wow.
He's in the original Halloween as Tommy Doyle, and he pops up as the first kid that buys paper. And when you see it, when you go back and watch it, you're like, oh, that's totally him.
Yeah,
like,
I can see him in my head now. And I'm kind of like seeing it. That's crazy, man.
So there's that.
That's awesome.
And really the last thing that we haven't touched upon that really makes this movie is the Tangerine Dream score.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of my favorite scores of all time. Funny because it's a little too close to Risky Business, and in fact I thought they just reused the Risky Business score initially. It's not, there are subtle differences, but it's basically the same theme. And on the commentary, Phil Juneau actually says, they came in and they did a really dark like score, like a little too dark for the movie, and they're like, eat this dark movie. He's a bad guy. Wants to kill kid. And he had to explain to them, no, this is what American high schools are like, and just it was lost to them. And so he kept referencing Risky Business. He's like, no, I want it like what you did for Risky Business. And that's what they got. And now, to this day, it's one of my favorite film scores is what they did for this.
So good. And there is something about them and the movies that they've done and how, I don't know what it is. It just creates this other heightened world feeling and makes the movie stand out. I can't, like Miracle Mile and Sorcerer and The Keep, all these movies have something extra because of those scores. And they should have done more 80s high school
movies. Who knows?
so anyway, obviously we both recommend this Blu-ray highly. You should, if you don't already own it, you should buy it right away.
Yes.
There's no question.
Shout always does a great job, and this is just a movie ripe for rediscovering. I do hope it gets. It's never going to be Karate Kid big, but or Teen Wolf big. But people really need to reevaluate this one.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that every person that I've ever shown it to you, I've never ever had somebody say, "No, I didn't like it."
Nope, always never. Blown away.
Never.
Elric's response to me was because he loved the way it was shot. He was just like wowed by the filmmaking technique. So, yeah, I can't imagine. This is our Just a Disc guarantee. You will love this movie.
Yeah, there's no question. 100%.
Yeah.
100% guaranteed. Anyway, thank you, Rob, so much for coming on to talk about this. It's been a long time coming. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Everybody go buy 3 O'Clock High. Have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week otherwise. Bye-bye.